Welcome. Tonight we look at the 9th century. The 9th century already, sponsored as always by Becky and Avi Katz, Leila Nishmas, Yona Ben Rav Aryeh Leib, Tena Shmosar, Tzurbasar Chaim. By the 9th century, there were stable, sizable Jewish communities across the civilized world, from Spain in Western and Western Europe, all the way to the easternmost regions of the Muslim Empire. Many Jewish communities developed, as we can imagine, along the trade routes bringing from east to west and back spices and minerals and other commodities. That's how the west and east were linked, and Jews were very heavily involved in that. And in the 9th century as well, these interactions would result in very fertile relationships between Jews on either side of the world. There was an interconnectedness that demonstrated that to the world that Jews were not just a religion and not just a people defined by a land, but in fact, in Rav Hirsch's later expression, a religio nation, meaning a nation that transcended the usual categories that defined nations and had a bond that really was unknown to any other nation in the world. One consequence of these new contacts was the increased awareness of Jews throughout the world of each other's existence, and occasionally through the auspices of exotic figures, sometimes charlatans, that would materialize out of thin air. The first of these individuals arose in the late 9th century, the late 1800s, by the name of Eldad Hadoni. Eldad Hadoni claimed to be a citizen of an independent Jewish state in Eastern Africa, in Ethiopia, that was populated by some of the missing 10 tribes. He said he was from the tribe of Dan, hence the name Eldad Hadoni, and in that kingdom, which was governed by Jews for Jews, three other tribes were there as well, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Eldad Hadoni was a merchant, traveled across most of the Eastern world, Arabia and the Orient, and told remarkable tales about Jewish life in Africa. As he traveled on business, he visited Jewish communities in Babel, even in Spain, and in Kairouan, in Egypt, where Jews had settled as well. He was the first of these gadabouts who would appear from time to time. When he first came across the more known Jewish community in Babel, he told a wild tale that in Africa he had been kidnapped by cannibals together with a corpulent fellow citizen of the kingdom from the tribe of Asher, and the hefty gentleman was consumed right away by these cannibals. He, Eldad Hadoni, was a little thin, so they threw him into a pit in order to be fattened. But in the meantime, before they could consume him, the cannibals were overrun by another tribe. He was taken to the Orient. There in the Orient, he was redeemed by a Jew, he said, from the tribe of Issachar, another one of the 10 tribes that had disappeared. And finally, Eldad Hadoni made his way west. Now, he cited some halachos that he said were part of Jewish life in his home kingdom, most of which are not kahalacha. So for example, he said that shchita that's not preceded by a bracha, v'tzivano ala shchita, is not valid. That's not the halacha, but he said that's the way they're noheg in Ethiopia. He reported on the whereabouts of all the 10 tribes that he'd encountered in his travels in his own kingdom, in Arabia, in the Orient, in Asia Minor, etc. How credible was he? Well, that's one of the mysteries. He did exist, that much is for sure. As for his stories, nobody really knows. The Christians were the first to try to debunk his tales as what he was claiming, that there was an independent Jewish kingdom in East Africa, did not fit together with Christian doctrine that Jews lost their independence because of our rejection of Jesus. If in fact there was an independent Jewish kingdom in Africa, Well, it couldn't be. Something had to give. So they're the ones who say that his story was fabricated, untrue. The Ibn Ezra, by coincidence, in this week's parsha, when he's talking about Zipporah, says that we should not rely on any work that's not composed by Nevi'im, or Chachamim Ipiya Kabbalah, not composed by prophets, or by our wise people based on the Mesorah, and he mentions like Sefer Eldad Hadoni, like that particular book, which is, he said, is fanciful. But the Mordechai and other Rishonim quote him as a source, if usually to disagree with something that he said, but if they're quoting him, he was at least taken seriously. Part of the fascination with Eldad Hadoni was that he seemed to be completely unaware of the Talmud. Remember, he's only 3.5-4 centuries past the composition of the Talmud, and the 10 tribes are gone already 11 centuries. He could not name even one Tana or Amora, and yet he did have this rich history, this rich Mesorah that was different than that of the Talmud, that apparently he said in his native land they obeyed. Tshuva is extant between the Jews of Kairouan and Reb Tzemach Gon that basically tells the story of Eldad Hadoni asking whether he's legitimate or not. Ultimately, he remains a mystery, but again, he's one of these fascinating, exotic characters that crop up from time to time in our history. Where were the Jews of Bavel now in the 9th century? Well, when we left the Jews of Bavel in the 8th century, they were racked by internal dissension, even if their external relations with the Muslim rulers were fairly innocuous. There was now a growing dispute in the Jewish world between ourselves and the Karaites, the Karaite movement that continued to expand and gain adherence in the 9th century. There were further conflicts between the Gaonim and the Reshe Galusa in the 9th century, as well as now a split that took place between the two yeshivas, the two great yeshivas, Sura and Pumbedisa. First, to the Reshe Galusa wars. Rav Shergon records in his Igeres that Mar Rav Avraham became the head of the yeshiva in Pumbedisa, although he was not declared the Gaon. In 816, with Mar Rav Yosef the Avbeistin, they did not become the Gaonim because both were embroiled, Rav Shergon writes, Biplugta de Daniel de David Nisian, in the dispute of Daniel and David, who were rival Reshe Galusa. So, in true Jewish fashion, Daniel, it may have been that they're brothers as well, Daniel was supported in his quest to be the Reish Galusa by the wealthy Jews of Baghdad and the yeshiva in Sura, and David was supported by others, including the yeshiva in Pumbedisa. Who appointed the Reish Galusa? Well, that was the job of the caliph, who didn't always take much interest in Jewish wars. So their feud here, David and Daniel, was settled by the caliph in a typically unfortunate way. He basically decided the institution meant nothing to him. So he decided that henceforth, any 10 men could form an independent religious community and elect a leader for themselves that would be recognized by the caliph. Whether those 10 men were Jews, or Christians, or Zoroastrians, or Karaites. Now this decree further splintered the Jewish community, and it diluted much of the influence and certainly prestige of the Reish Galusa. In fact, already in the 820s, the Reish Galusa ceased to be a political force, but that didn't stop anyone from fighting over the position because it did still carry with it some financial wherewithal. However, the Reish Galusa issue was resolved. In Pumbedisa, both Mar Rav Avram and Mar Rav Yosef served as Gaonim in Pumbedisa at the same time, not as Gaonim, but as the heads of the yeshiva, with Rav Avram taking precedence. That came to an end very abruptly, in actually a very poignant way. Rav Shergon writes that once when the shamis of Vashul in Baghdad announced that there'd be a shear by the heads of the yeshiva in Pumbedisa, And he said the people should come listen to the Torah words of the Roshei Nesivta, of the heads of the yeshiva. The heads, that expression, Roshei, were something to which the people were unaccustomed, because there was always one head, the Rosh Yeshiva, Bachu Yisrael, Rav Shurigon writes. They just all started to cry about what had befallen the Jewish people. They couldn't agree on who's to be the Gaon. On the spot, Mar Rav Yosef resigned as Gaon and said he would resume his position as of Beis Din. For that he was publicly blessed by Mar Rav Avram, and in fact Mar Rav Avram became the Gaon in Pumbedisa, and when he died Mar Rav Yosef took over. That peace now reigned in Pumbedisa would loom very large in the next few decades, because there'd be major changes in the yeshiva in Sura. Now Sura had been dominant for more than a century, and the Gaonim of Sura were always given prominence over the Gaonim of Pumbedisa. For example, as we recall from last week, a few times Rabbonim had been taken from Sura and been appointed the Gaonim of Pumbedisa. On the Rigla de Reish Galusa, on the annual Shabbos, on which the Reish Galusa was honored by all the heads of the yeshivas, it would be the Gaon of Sura who would read from the Torah. Whenever they were together, the Gaon of Sura, the Gaon of Pumbedisa, the Gaon of Sura would be the one to make Hamotzi or lead the benching. So the Gaon of Sura always took precedence. Furthermore, the Jews of Bavel were taxed to support these great yeshivas. Apparently that was the custom of that time. Who knows, could become the custom of our time as well. But they were taxed. For a long time, though, Sura took two-thirds of the money, the tax money that was raised, and Pumbedisa one-third the money. Sura was also larger, had more Talmidim. All of this would change, and change very abruptly. In 841, the Gaon of Sura, Rav Moshe Bar Mar Yaakov Kahana, died, and he was not immediately replaced. Why he wasn't replaced? It's also a little enigmatic. It could be that there was no one who was of his esteem or caliber to replace him at that particular moment. It could be for reasons more nefarious. For 2 years, the Reish Galusa, a man named Ukba, who by most accounts was a decent person, although with sticky fingers, he did not appoint a new Gaon of Sura, and instead he diverted the funds that were sent to Sura by the Jews of Khorasan, which was a city in Persia. He diverted them into his own account, thereby enriching himself and leaving yeshiva in Sura more or less impoverished. When in 842 he appointed a new Gaon, Rav Kohen Tzedek, together with a Gaon of Pumbedisa, Rav Poltai Gaon, attempted to regain Sura's rightful claim to that money. That's not always easy to do. It became a major cause celeb and precipitated a very sharp dispute with Rav Kohen Tzedek's patron, the Reish Galusa Ukba, a dispute in which the Muslims again became involved, and they decided to banish Ukva to his country estate and replace him for the purpose of peace. In time, though, Ukva was reappointed Reish Galusa by a new caliph because of bribes that he paid, and during the 20 years that he served as Reish Galusa for the second time, Sura was eclipsed by Pumbedisa in size, in number of students, in quality of learning, and even in influence. Just as importantly, because of all the shenanigans, the financing of Sura and Pumbedisa more or less equaled out as well. So Sura lost money, Pumbedisa gained. For the next two centuries, until the end of the Tkufas HaGaonim, Pumbedisa would be the preeminent yeshiva in Bavel, even if we'll see both will relocate by the end of this century. Notwithstanding all these controversies, the yeshiva in Sura still produced outstanding gaonim that would shape Jewish life in permanent ways. In 853, Rav Netranai Gon was appointed, and he became the most prolific author of tshuvos among the Gaonim, answering questions from across the world, questions by the hundreds, questions that were brought to Sura very often by Jewish traders and merchants as they were passing through these towns. Wherever they were, they picked up questions in writing, delivered them to the Gaon, and then someone else going back en route would deliver it to whatever town the question came from. Most of these questions we still have. Now we're talking in the 850s. Some of the questions will surprise you. For example, and the issues that he dealt with were details, very common questions that Rabbanu asked today. He was asked, does a person hold his tzitzis during Kriyas Shema? While reciting Kriyas Shema, do you hold the tzitzis? Whatever the meaning is today, Rav Netranai Gaon answered, Dover zeh lo derech hachomim v'talmidim hu. To hold tzitzis during Kriyas Shema, that's not the way of the wise, nor of their students. He said, once you look at the tzitzis, after putting them on, making the bracha, to hold them during Kriyas Shema is derech yiseros. It's something extra, maybe even a bit haughty. And he said, what will you do when you come to Kshartam? Will you then hold your tefillin? And what will you do when you come to Chsavtam al Mizbeisecho? Will you run home to hold your mezuzah? He said, whoever does this should be taught Shalo Yasa. That should not be done. Or he was asked, very common question, unfortunately, what should a latecomer to shul say? The tzibur is finishing Kriyas Shema. He's just walking in. See, nothing ever changes. What should he say? So Rav Netranai Gaon said, he can't just say the Amidah, the Shemoneh Esrei, along with them, because you have to say Shabbat first. So he said, if there's no time, then he should say Baruch Shamar, and Ashrei, and Yishtabach, and then Shema and Shemoneh Esrei, which is basically the halacha today, but he was the first to codify it, and that's become the, unfortunately, the norm of the latecomers. But he said, don't say Pesukah Dezimra after davening. Now people tend to make up Pesukah Dezimra during Chazaras HaShatzu. Afterwards, he said it should not be done, because the takana of Pesukah Dezimra is dafka before the Shemoneh Esrei, not after, should not be said. Or he dealt with a very important question, what to do about Karaites returning to the fold? Do they need tvila b'mikvah like gerim? They have to immerse themselves in the mikvah like converts? And he said no, that the Karaites are Jews, but after they come to the community, after they returned and are suitably punished, all that is necessary is for them to stand up in shul, renounce their evil, and commit to Torah. After that, they should be fully accepted and not turned away. And by the way, there are similar questions in that genre today as well. These are questions by the hundreds that Rav Netranai answered. And the questions and answers are very brief, by the way. Because he's talking again. Transmission was difficult. It was scraps of paper. And each question is a line, and each answer is not more than a paragraph or two. Just the basic halacha, sometimes the source from the Gemara as well. Rav Netranai Gaon was the teacher and predecessor of Rav Amram Gaon, who was the Gaon in Sura from 857 until 875, 18 years, and his crowning achievement was truly historic. Until his time, people had a very loose understanding of the framework of tefillah. Tefillah, prayer, had been mostly unchanged since the Anshei Knesset HaGdola had drafted the basics of tefillah almost 1,000 years earlier, Pesukah Dezimra and Shema, Shemoneh Esrei, but many changes and discrepancies had crept in. In response to a question from the Jews of Spain and their leader of Yitzhak ben Rav Shimon, Rav Amram Gaon composed and produced the very first Seder Tefillah in the 850s. And that was first sent to Spain, and that became the basic Seder for all Jews. And it's still extant, known today, until today, as the Seder of Amram Gaon. I quote from the introduction. Beautiful introduction he writes, and again, the flavor of it is very similar to what you find today. Amram bar Sheshna Reshma Sifta de Mosa Machsio, Amram the son of Sheshna, the head of the yeshiva, Mosa Machsio, which was Suro, L'Rabbeinu Yitzchak Breda Morona V'Rabbona Shimon, Rabbi Yitzchak, the son of Shimon, Chavivi Akir V'Nechbad Aleinu V'Yeshiva Kula, who's very dear and precious and honored to us, esteemed by us and the entire yeshiva. Shalom Rav. The mercies of heaven should be on you and your descendants, and all the scholars and disciples and our brethren in Israel who dwell there in Spain. Please accept the peace from us, from Rav Tzemach, who actually was the Gaon in Pumbedisa at the time, in Surah at the time. Umin alufim v'chachmei yeshiva uvnei yeshiva shalonu, from the leaders and the rabbanim and the talmidim of our yeshiva and our city, mechasya shekulam b'shalom. We're all in peace here. Chachamim talmidim achen yisrael shuim kan. All the wise men and students and our brothers Israel who dwell here, shetamid anu shalom b'shalomchem. We always inquire after your welfare. V'zachrim eschem b'zikaron ra'tov. And we remember you with a good memory. Now, of course, he's not talking about a real memory, but a historical memory, because most of the Jews of Spain had left a century or two earlier and moved westward, although, of course, there was still immigration from Bavel westward now, certainly in the 9th century. He said, we all remember your community, umispalim batchem, we pray for you, umivakshim rachma lechem, we invoke God's mercy upon you, sheirachem akadosh baruch hu berachmav harabim v'yagen alechem, v'yatzileschem mikol tzora v'nezak mikocholi umakov, umishilton ra. And God should protect you and save you from all travail and harm and illness and suffering, and from bad rulers as well. Umikomine mashchis, umikomine puranios amisrakshos baolam, and from any destructive force, any harm that comes in the world, v'yemale barachim of harabim komishalos libchem. And God should, in His mercy, abundant compassion, fulfill all the desires of your heart. He says, this question came, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Rabbani Yitzchak, Esrim Zehuvim Shishagartel Yeshiva, the question came to us from a Rabbi Yaakov, son of Rabbi Yitzchak, who brought with him 10 gold coins to the yeshiva, 5 for us, and 5 for the Kupah Shel Yeshiva. It must have been 5 for the office of the Gaon and 5 for the yeshiva in Sura. V'tzivonu berachnu oscha bracha shizkan b'cha uvezaracha v'zerazaracha. So the guy brought a little donation also along with the question, which I would imagine was part of the fundraising effort as well. And now he starts. V'seder tilos ubrachos shoshana kula shesha'alto, the order of the prayers and brachos of the entire you asked about, sheheronim and ashamayim, shown to us from heaven, ra'inu l'sader l'hoshev kemisar shabiyodeinu ketikun tanom v'marom. Now we see fit to put it in writing and to respond exactly according to the tradition that we have from the time of the Tanom and Amoram. Rav Amram began with a basic discussion of the laws of the Tefillah, and then with the texts, beginning with the 100 brachos that a Jew should recite every day, as enumerated by Rav Netzer Naigon. He was the first to list those 100 brachos that a Jew should recite every day. And then the order of the Siddur, that's very familiar to us. Seder of Amram Gaon begins with that halachic introduction, and then Alantias Hedai, Men Asher Yatzar, and all the Birchas HaShachar, including Shalosh Sani Yisho, which is in the Gemara, but not Shasani Kirtzono, which came 3 or 4 centuries later. Thus he goes through the entire davening, weaving together the halachos and then the text, a full service for Yemei Chol, for Shabbos, for Yom Tov, essentially, it wasn't just the first Siddur, it's the first Machzor as well. If you would pick up a Seder of Amram Gaon and daven from that today, I would estimate that more than 90% of it is the same. And the basic text is familiar. How did all the different nuschos arise? Like Shemoneh Esrei has 5 or 6 different texts. Well, since the brachos of the Shemoneh Esrei were so familiar to everyone, it was recited orally, he only wrote the first few words. And the chasima, the end of the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem Chonin Hadas, although we are aware of his text, he would just write the beginning in v'chule. But different communities added on words or thoughts on their own, since in the basic text, especially the bakashos, there's room for supplementation, for bakasha, for individual or communal petitions. You could add to almost any bracha in the bakashos. Only the conclusion has to remain uniform. Chonin Hadas, Harotzeh Beshuvah, Mevarach Hashonim, etc. So there, in fact, you find with all the different nuschos, Eidot HaMizrach, Ashkenaz, Ari, etc., the ending is always the same. The other text is different, and so it has remained until today. Now, this Siddur was a monumental achievement. Once the Seder of Amargon reached Spain, soon after it reached all the communities in the world, and that became the basic Siddur that Jews use. Of course, every couple of centuries there'd be a new edition of the Siddur with updated halachos or new cases, sometimes even new tfilos, but that would be the basics. Now, there are hints that Rav Amram Gon, upset that Rav Netranai was chosen as Gon of Sura ahead of him, left and established his own yeshiva. Eventually, though, he became the Gon of Sura, and he was succeeded there by Mar Rav Nachshon Bar Rav Tzadok as Gon. Rav Nachshon was credited with discovering an important sequence in the Jewish calendar, which might not mean as much to you as it does to me. He found, you remember the calendar of Hillel that was enacted in 359 of the Common Era, established the Jewish calendar with a pattern that there'll be 7 leap months every 19 years. And that's the cycle of the calendar. Rav Nachshon Gon discovered that the pattern repeats itself in 13 cycles of 19 years each. That is to say, the Hebrew calendar was synchronized with the solar year through leap months 7 times every 19 years, but the whole calendar repeats itself every 13 times 19. That is to say, every 247 years, the calendar is identical. He did have a lot of time on his hands, apparently. This is called the Machzor of Rav Nachshon Gon, his cycle, and that means for each year of the 247 years, Yom Tov will fall on the same day. You find, because everyone knows about the 19-year cycle, and people will ask, how come there's no symmetry? Every 19 years it's roughly the same, but it's like off by a day or so, or 2 days. That's the answer. The cycle is actually not a 19-year cycle, but our calendar is a 247-year cycle. So if you just project ahead, every 247 years, if you should live as long, you'll see that the calendar repeats itself. You need not, therefore, print 10 calendars annually. All you really need are 247 different calendars. But of greater significance than Machzor of Rav Nachshon Gon, he was succeeded as Gon by his brother Rav Tzemach Gon. Rav Tzemach Gon composed the first dictionary of the Talmud known as the Oruch, the arrangement. This is important. By the 9th century, Arabic had replaced Aramaic as the common language of the Jewish people. Aramaic became, and remain today, relegated to a language of Torah, and that's it. A language of Talmud, except for some small communities in the Middle East where it's still spoken today, like parts of Syria. One of the doctors in Shul has a patient from a small village in Syria where Aramaic was their tongue. The patient speaks no English or Hebrew, but Aramaic, and he knows a little Aramaic from the Gemara, and that's how they communicate. How many pills a day? Treo plus, 2 or 3. And that's how they talk to each other. With the disappearance of Aramaic as a spoken tongue, so many expressions in the Talmud were in danger of being lost, or at least misconstrued. So Rav Tzemach Gon So Gaona Pumbedita, from 872 to 890, he compiled a list of more than 300 Aramaic terms, translated them into Arabic, as well as a listing of the names and places of in the Talmud. Sometimes you'll find, for example, there'll be a strange word, and Rashi will say, Shem Makom Hu, or Shem Ishu, the name of a person or a place, and that explains it. And he disseminated this dictionary across the world as well. Don't be confused. 2 centuries later, another dictionary, more famous, with the same name, would be published by Reb Nosson, the head of the yeshiva in Rome, apparently at behest of the church. We'll get back to that in a couple of weeks. And that was a dictionary of Aramaic to Hebrew, which then the church officials used. They understood Hebrew, not Aramaic. And that became really the first dictionary that had a general circulation in Jewish life, because Hebrew was also a Torah language, as was Aramaic, because Hebrew is used in tefillah. It always had a greater understanding, a greater, more Jews comprehended Hebrew than Aramaic. Well, the 9th century found its share of instability as well across the world. In Babel itself, the Muslims were beginning their retreat from a century of openness and tolerance. You recall from the 8th century that the Muslims had reached their maximum in terms of physical conquest. They had been repelled by the Christians of Europe. Now they were in somewhat of a retreat, and they're turning inward, which basically has not changed. They haven't yet reverted to a more outward posture. Was spurred by internal tensions and the feelings among the citizenry that the caliphs were more pleasure seekers than they were divine servants. So, as a result, the caliph Al-Ma'mun from 813 to 833 brought in Turkish garrisons that would constitute a buffer between his own people and himself. He was afraid of vengefulness on the part of the populace because he wasn't that pious, at least not at first. So he brought in a guard of external. He didn't even trust his own army. That's why he brought in these foreigners to defend him. To protect himself even further, he began enforcing a single view of Islam. Recall that Islam itself had been divided into 3, 4, 5 different factions. Well, this did not last long. His successor had to leave Baghdad entirely, as, you know, he brought in the Turkish garrisons to protect him. What did they do? They overthrew him. So the Turks rose in power. By the reign of Al-Wathiq in 842, the Arabs of Arabia, Baghdad especially, were in open rebellion against the Turkish forces, but the Turks won. And the next caliph tried desperately to regain control over his kingdom and his army. That caliph, Al-Wathiq's brother, Al-Mutawakkil, took power in 847 and tried to curry favor with the Arabs by building impressive mosques, including what's called today the Great Mosque of Samarra. You may recall the Great Mosque of Samarra with its spiral minaret. It looks different than all other mosques. It was damaged by insurgents in 2005. They shot the top off that mosque, which was 1,300 years old. More to the point, to curry favor with the Arabs, he imposed severe restrictions on the Jews and the Christians of Arabia, including Babel. So he, Al-Mutawakkil, introduced in the 850s the yellow badge that became so infamous in Jewish life. Originally in his time, it was a yellow-colored hood and belt that Jews and Christians had to wear. He also destroyed a number of shuls, but he too was eventually murdered by one of his Turkish soldiers in 861, succeeded by his son, Al-Muntasir. His son, not a lot of nafis from the son was part of a conspiracy to kill his father. And the son, Al-Muntasir, he himself lasted just a half year. In the middle of all this turmoil, the Jews were concentrated in the larger cities of Bavel, especially in Baghdad. And as Jews had coalesced again in the urban areas away from the rural areas, they lived mainly in Baghdad, in Mosul, and Basra, all cities that are familiar to us today. Baghdad is Baghdad. Mosul is in the north of Iraq. That's the city of Nineveh, of biblical fame. It's now in the Kurdish area of Iraq. And Basra, of course, is in southern Iraq on the Persian Gulf. All of them were commercial capitals. But Jews were already migrating westward. When Jews left Bavel, the immediate consequence was, we all know this, a loss of funding for the two yeshivas. Jews moved to Europe, and they stopped supporting Sur and Pumbedisa. They began supporting the local institutions. So their funding decreased simply because there were now fewer Jews in Bavel, additionally because the yeshivas had become the breeding ground for Jewish rabbinical leaders outside Bavel. Graduates, musmachim, of Sur and Pumbedisa were being sent to Eretz Yisrael, to North Africa, to Europe, etc., to lead the communities there, and new centers were being created. As a result of this decline in both numbers of Talmidim and money as well, by the end of the century, both yeshivas had relocated, first leaving Pumbedisa and then leaving Sura, and both setting up shop in Baghdad, where they would remain for the next 150 years, retaining their original names, just like we do today with European-named yeshivas that exist in America or Israel. But they actually here existed in Baghdad for the last century and a half of their tenure. In the 890s, by coincidence, both yeshivas were also led by Gaonim named Rav Haigon, but not the famous Rav Haigon of the 11th century, who was the last Gaon in the Tkufas HaGaonim. So by the end of the 9th century, yeshivas in Sur Pumbedisa were gone in those cities, and they now existed in Baghdad. Within 3 centuries from now, there would be no Jews at all living in Sura. And so we don't really know clearly where Sura was located today. Jews live for a bit longer in Pumbedisa, but the yeshiva in Sura itself, that was founded, some say, by Yechezkel HaNovi, and in more modern times by the great Amora Rav in the 3rd century, that yeshiva in Sura was gone by the end of the 9th century, and Baghdad, which would be the capital of Islam for 5 centuries until the year 1258, now became the largest Jewish city in the world as well, in terms of population and in terms of Torah scholarship and leadership. Meanwhile, in Europe, Jews were expanding their holdings and becoming more integrated into European Christian society. Now, integrated may be too strong a word. It's not that they were assimilating, but rather that Europe's economy in the 9th century became more and more dependent on Jews. Charlemagne's son, Louis the First, known also as Louis the Pious, I tried to add that to my name too, it didn't work. Louis the Pious assumed the throne of the Franks in 814, and he in fact was noted for his decent treatment of the Jews and others. One of his nicknames, in addition to Louis the Pious, was Louis the Fair, because he was a very fair monarch. He even issued, and again it's unprecedented and really unheard of in context, to 3 Jewish families in Lyon and in Saragossa in Spain, a charter with rights and privileges. They should own land. They were even allowed to have Christian servants. They were exempt from royal taxes. One of them is known, a Rabbi Donatus and his nephew Shmuel, who received their charters, lords of the manor, essentially, in the year 823. Even more astounding, I guess, one of these stories that you just know, it's a puzzle how it should happen. It's astonishing. There was a priest, a deacon in the court of Louis the First named Bodo, who became very close to the Jewish merchants who frequented the palace of Louis the First, and in 825 he became a Ger Tzedek. He converted to Judaism, taking the name Elazar. This is known historically as the Bodo Elazar controversy. Now his conversion, imagine a deacon in the palace of Louis I converts to Yahdus. The conversion greatly angered the Jew-hating Archbishop Abogard, but Elazar fled to Muslim Spain in 838, and he lived peacefully, even writing a book about the Muslim Mashiach, which he said would be vengeance on the world for the humiliation of the Jews. Allegedly, he even tried in Spain, where it was safe, to convert Spanish Christians to Judaism. And it's known that he engaged in probably the very first Christian-Jewish debate with a theologian in Cordoba named Paulus Alvarus. They debated theology in front of the public, so it was a real farbrenta. Beyond that, not much is known about him. The community that first rises to prominence in Europe is actually in Italy, where a father and son team of great Rabbonim, Rav Moshe Zokain and his son Colonimus, were leaders. Famous family, Colonimus, later moved to Germany at the invitation of direct descendants of Charlemagne, known as the king of that area, known as Charles the Bald, and his son Charles the Fat. If you're going to have an appellation the after your name, I guess it's better to be known as the pious or the fair than the bald or the fat. Both Charles the Bald, Charles the Fat, in the middle of the 9th century, Charles the Bald also started a tradition, had a Jewish doctor named Reb Tzidkiah, apparently could not cure his baldness. Now the Colonimus family were well known to Talmidei Chachamim, and they left Italy and established a yeshiva in Mainz in Germany. There's another Rav, Rav Machir, who came directly from Bavel, and in the late 9th century set up a yeshiva in Provence in southern France, which would be a Jewish center of learning for centuries hence. The 10,000 Jews in Ashkenaz, not many, at the beginning of the 9th century grew in numbers and wealth and influence by the end of the 9th century. And the Italian Jewish community was greatly aided by the arrival in 850 of a Jew named Aaron of Baghdad. Wasn't a Rav, was a businessman, but he became an important conduit between Italian Jewry and Babylonian Jewry. Meanwhile, a little further to the east, the declining Jewish population of Byzantium suffered in a manner so typical it almost deserves no mention. The Byzantine Empire was in steady decline because they'd also shut out the world and focused on just wars and the kings enriching themselves. The famous emperor Basil I, founder of the Macedonian dynasty, under whose reign Byzantium recovered most of its territorial holdings, he initiated the forced baptism of Jews in 873. All that did was drive Jews further away from the Byzantine Empire, which again was in a very, very steady and steep decline. One of the great figures in Jewish history emerged at the end of the 9th century. He was born in Fayum in Egypt in the Nile Delta, known as Al-Fayumi, born either in 882 or 892, seems more reasonable, 892. He moved to Israel at a young age to learn Torah in Tiberia, and then he burst onto the Jewish scene first at the age of 20 with an important sefer that he wrote. So he would shape the Jewish world as a philosopher and polemicist as Gaon in the 10th century. I'm referring, of course, to Rav Saadia Al-Fayumi, Rav Saadia Gaon. In the 10th century, he would be a major figure, and they're really legendary historic figures that dominated these different sectors of Jewish life in the 10th century, as we'll discuss. Rav Saadia Gaon in Bavel, in Ashkenaz, Rabbeinu Gershom, Maor HaGola, and in Spain, Chasdai Ibn Shaprut, who's both involved in Torah and secular political leadership as well. just to summarize, as we've seen over the weeks, each century really builds on the one preceding it. So the shift of the center of Jewish life from east to west was accelerating the 9th century as feuds would weaken the Jewish community in Bavel, would strip the Reshe Goluso of any real power, and would leave the two great yeshivos reeling, and indeed eventually relocating to Baghdad. Jews became a truly international people, symbolized on one level by the appearance of Eldad Hadoni with his exotic tales of Jewish life in Africa and Asia. And yet, within this turmoil, Bavel Jews remained unsurpassed in Torah greatness, produced the first Siddur, which is still extant, and the first dictionary of the Talmud as well. As always, great figures would define the next century, the 10th, as the heyday of Bavel Jews would near its end, and great Jews would shape events in Western Europe and among the people of Israel. I thank you very much for your kind attention. Next time we discuss the 10th century, that'll be 2 weeks from tonight. There's no class next week.